back to BCFM's politics show on Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Why is Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne a cokehead in denial? Because he's clearly trying to cover up his coke-snorting exploits in the 1990s. We hear former dominatrix and author of Chief Whip, Natalie Rowe, and how she was raided by the police when she released a photo of herself with George Osborne with a gram of cocaine in front of them on the table. Also, Beast Technology. How would you like a superpower pill that lets you into cars through any security just by touching it? The coolest pill in the world that you swallow, or a technology too far? From the former DARPA director Regina Duggan, we hear a little bit later on. Also, the sad death this week of World War II MI6 agent and confidant of Ian Fleming. Also, Winston Churchill, Lord Mountbatten of Burma, as well as King George VI. I'm talking about John Ainsworth Davis, known affectionately as JAD. He said he was involved in a daring raid at the end of the war to snatch the Nazis' loot for the Allies in the form of Hitler's party secretary and treasurer, Martin Bormann. Using the pen name Christopher Crichton to get round the Official Secrets Act, he wrote the gripping book Op JB, said that Fleming's famous James Bond books were a subtle hint back to this top-secret wartime mission. I'm joined on the line now by Lawrence DeMello from Buenos Aires in Argentina, who's a very close confidant of John Ainsworth Davis, who sadly died this week. Hi, Lawrence, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me back.
Could you just first of all explain, Lawrence, how old was Jab when he died?
Well, Jab would have been 90 early next year, so he was 89. It's quite funny now because talking about it, I forgot how old he was, but he was completely compos mentis, especially in these last years. It's just only in the last couple of months that he really went downhill. Unfortunately, he had a stroke about 3 months ago, a very small stroke. But then it affected his eating, etc. So unfortunately, he contracted a few infections and he went downhill. And sadly, we lost him on Monday.
So for those that have never heard of John Ainsworth Davis, who was he?
Okay, John Ainsworth Davis, I think we went over this another previous interview. He was a British operative and he was groomed and taken into under the wing of Churchill and was doing operations on behalf of Desmond Morton and Winston Churchill. And he worked throughout World War II and even post-World War II doing sort of intelligence ops for the British. But the saddest thing which I want to put across today is he was passed off as a charlatan. And I find it very sad in that I've seen so much documentary evidence, Tony, and I've seen so much paperwork and spoken to people that are genuine, verifiable witnesses to what went on with Martin Bormann getting out of Europe, and that he certainly did. And I find it the saddest thing about losing John is the fact that he never actually had the chance to witness that people could see that he was the real deal. Not that that was important to him, but it was important to me for a man that sacrificed so much for Britain and went through so much that was cast off as a charlatan.
So why this attempt to say that he was basically not telling the truth? Is this simply the fact that it was another way of dealing with his revelations so that they didn't have to prosecute him under the Official Secrets Act?
I don't think it's anything. I think the thing is, let's be honest, anybody that does any covert operations or anybody that comes out the closet, so to speak, has to be character assassinated. I mean, that's the normal way that governments work. You are not going to allow one of your agents to walk free and sort of talk about what he did. You know, I mean, let's be honest, if something came out tomorrow and somebody said that they were involved in the death of Dr. David Kelly, I mean, he's not going to get 5 minutes on the air, is he? Let's be honest. And there have been lots of stories of people that have come out with information and they've been trashed as being loonies or, you know, the modern word, which I find so irritating, is conspiracy theorists. And it's very, very frustrating because we need to separate this thing where you have these people that jump on the bandwagon who want to be involved with the David Icke, they want to be with the Alex Jones, etc., and people that go out there and just blab their mouth off with no factual with information that are facts. We have facts, and there are multiple facts that John Ainsworth Davis was who he said he was. I was listening, I don't want to go off on a tangent, but I was listening to the interview that you did with Jill Bennett. I don't know if that, I think it's a little bit relevant.
Yeah, okay. Well, Jill Bennett, just to fill listeners in, was the former librarian for the, chief librarian for the Foreign Office. And she wrote a book, didn't she, about this guy, the enigmatic Desmond Morton. The book's called Winston Churchill's Man of Mystery. Now, can you explain a little bit about Jill, what interests you about Jill, and also who Morton was? Because he was a very important confidant of John Ainsworth Davis.
Yes, he was. But also, we mustn't forget that Miss Bennett, although she's a wonderful writer, and I'm not in any way taking away from the work that she's done, she is, at the end of the day, a librarian and researcher. And let's not forget, she's not an independent librarian or researcher. She's working for the Foreign Office. So she's paid by the government, and she said herself she was an official appointed historian. Now, we have to be very careful with the terminology historian today. Now, you have people that say, I'm a historian, so I know. This, the root of this is Bormann getting out of Berlin. And John Ainsworth Davis was discredited because he said he was involved in the operation. Bormann was taken out of Berlin. He got away to South America. He survived. Now, John Ainsworth Davis is not the only person that says this. There are many very qualified researchers, investigators, scientists, doctors that have said this is correct. Now, when we get somebody like Miss Bennett, she's done this book, which is supposed to be, I suppose, the Bible on Morton, and I do admire her because it's an enormous task to tackle Morton's life and biography. But at the end of the day, what is Jill doing? Jill has documented what has been made available. Now, I was quite curious when she said that she'd had access to secret files. Now, let's be real. If I was wanting to write a book about David Kelly, for example, and I write to the government, can I access the files? Do you honestly believe they're going to allow me to pull the files on Kelly? Now, let's go. She has no field experience. Okay, so you cannot comment on operations that existed based on whether they have a paper trail or not. Because field operations that are highly secret are compartmentalized, as you know. And if they are really potentially revealing, there will be no paper trail. There won't be anything. Because at the highest level where Morton was, there are usually very dirty jobs to be done without attribution, as we know, and this means no paper trail. And the proof of this comes from the operatives themselves, if you can find them, and you need to talk to them. And Jill Bennett, as far as I know, never even interviewed John Ainsworth Davis, although she said that she investigated his life, etc. Did she actually call him and speak to him? No, she didn't. I actually have some communication from Jill Bennett to one of my assistants that was written in 2006. And my assistant at the time was trying to get a very good young journalist, and he was trying to get information about files on John Ainsworth Davis at the Foreign Office. And Jill came back and completely said it was a load of rubbish, the story. But the thing is, Miss Bennett, in her public interview with you, she admitted that Morton lived near Churchill at Chartwell, which is exactly what Jad said, that he grew up and he lived on the estate. It's also interesting that Morton was involved with the commission that was to find the gold post-World War II. Now, that's exactly what Jad says, is that Morton headed the operation as a way to get Bormann, hold of Bormann, so him and Churchill could get hold of all the bank accounts, the funds, etc., that Bormann was managing. You know, without going into the whole thing, and without, I'm not trying to discredit her in any way, but it was very, very interesting that I saw the visuals on your interview that you did. I didn't hear the live broadcast. But I saw the visuals, and you threw a question at Miss Bennett saying, now, this is Miss Bennett, who supposedly is the person that knows so much about Morton. And she said to you, you asked her if he was a Mason. And she said words to the effect of, no, I haven't seen any evidence of that. Although he played the role of a Mason to milk information from businessmen. Now, let's get real. You cannot play the role of a cardinal at the Vatican, a Vatican meeting with a bunch of cardinals. You're either one of them or you're not one of them. Then you mentioned the fact about Churchill being a Mason, a member of a lodge. And again, Miss Bennett turned around and said, no, I have never seen any evidence of that. And the evidence is absolutely, you cannot get more evidence than his paraphernalia, his writing desk, his ritualistic sort of goods that went on sale, which you actually published the photographs of. So What are we dealing with here? We have to separate historians and people that are working for the government. Of course they're not going to turn around. Even in that moment, she couldn't turn around and say, well, actually, yes, I didn't focus on that. Yes, but it actually appears that Churchill was a Mason. She could not say it. She could not say it. Why couldn't she say it?
Okay, but tell us a little bit more about this secret James Bond mission and what evidence there was that Martin Bormann actually did survive World War II.
Well, I think the thing is we have to, and this is what I found very frustrating with the mainstream media, you know, anybody mentions Bormann, nobody actually puts down on the page the whole story of how it works. And I don't know if I can take 5 minutes just to give a background, a timeline, so people can start putting the bits together. We all know Martin Bormann was Hitler's chancellor. He was his right-hand man. He held the keys to all the plundered wealth of Nazi Germany, which was secretly held in bank accounts, deposits around the world. So not just cash, deeds, and stocks, but he had vast access to vast amounts of gold, priceless works of art. Now, Bormann was tried in absentia. Now, you only try somebody in absentia when there is no body and you know you think they're alive. And he was tried at the Nuremberg trials in 1946, and he was found guilty of war crimes, and as a consequence, he was sentenced to death by hanging, but of course. Now, there were two Nazi witnesses at the Nuremberg trials that gave unverifiable testimony to the fact that they'd seen Bormann and his fellow Nazi, Dr. Ludwig Stumpfegger, who he was last seen with, dead, supposedly hours after seeing the bunker, where Hitler supposedly shot himself, but that's another story. So from 1945, there was a massive manhunt for Martin Bormann. Now, you have to remember, during those first years, the post-war years, the German government was also involved looking for Martin Bormann. But there was a concentrated search effort, Tony. People forget this. You know, it wasn't just, oh, he's disappeared. From 1945, around the site of the supposed place where he was seen, I mean, there was massive of hordes of Allied troops on the ground that coordinated a thorough search, so no stone was left unturned. And at the same time, there was an independent search done by a recon group after Lieutenant General Konstantin Telegin of the 5th Shock Army was delivered of a diary said to be a foreman's, which was found near the same site. So in those first post-war years, it was not a cold case as it is today. So there were lots of fresh memories, the ground was still soft, and any such corpses, although decomposed, would have certainly been on or near the surface and easily identified with a minimum of forensics. Now, not one scrap of flesh was found of either man, that was Stumpfegger or Bormann, but at least they found remains of Hitler, which they could dispute. So now let's fast forward a second. So we go to 1972. So he disappears. Nobody's seen him, supposedly, okay? 1972, construction workers come across human remains near the Leipzig station in Berlin. Now, this was the site where supposedly there had been Allied troops searching and digging. I mean, you know how soldiers do. You have Russians searching for him. They found nothing. So you have these construction workers, and they unearth these bones. Now, the world's press were gathered to hear if this was indeed Bormann. And Bormann's Nazi dentist, Dr. Hugo Blass, was called, and he recalled from his memory his former patient's dental physiology, and he gave testimony that they were one and the same. Now, you have to remember, he was a Nazi dentist. Now, you're going to say, if the man has gone away, you're going to say, yeah, that's him, because you have to stop them from looking for him. Now, the case was closed, and they said he was found, it was published to the world, 1972, yes, we found the remains of Bormann, he's dead. Everybody fed on that. And it was not until 1998 that, due to the advances in modern science, the remains were subjected to a DNA forensic study by the West German prosecutor. Now, I was in touch with one of the doctors that was involved in the 1998 DNA forensics of that. They were very, very difficult, trust me. And when I asked to access certain files, they were very, very difficult. But I was told, and I also saw in paperwork, as an addendum to that investigation, the reason for this new 1998 investigation was that in 1996, Christopher Crichton, our man, JAD, John Ainsworth Davis, which is a pseudonym, had published a book, Off JB, in which he claimed that he was instructed by Winston Churchill and Desmond Morton to rescue Martin Bormann. Now, that book in 1996 unsettled the German government so much to the extent that they did a thorough forensics and DNA investigation carried out on the remains. Now, they used blood from supposedly one of Bormann's nieces. I haven't been given a name, and I'm trying to track on that. And the forensic results did conclude that the remains that were found in 1972 were indeed a foreman. Now, the confirmation of the remains, being those of foreman, was released to the world's press. So I admit, I agree, they were Bormann's remains, okay, found in 1972 in Berlin. That's fine. Now, due to the DNA confirmation of the skeleton, modern historians now are teaching their students that the stories of Bormann escaping to South America are false. Nothing more than conspiracy theorist rantings, and we're all madmen. And if anybody dares raise the questions as to the dynamics of Bormann's disappearance and death, we're discredited based solely on the DNA confirmation of the skeleton. But you have to say, well, why are we, what is the big deal that we're saying he got out? We're not saying that that's not Bormann. We're saying that he got out. So why are there conflicting stories between the official version of those that are seriously investigated? Okay, we know Bormann's dead. His remains were found in 1972. But Tony, that does not mean he died in 1945.
No, but I've seen also reports that have said that there was some kind of red clay on the skeleton, which could not have possibly been from a German burial.
Right, so I don't want to sort of rant on, but I want to just try and get a timeline. So, what is at stake if it was proven that he died much later than we led to believe? Now, that's a big question. So, even though we need to get this over to people that are interested in this, they don't just fob it off, no, he died in 45, they found his remains. Even though his remains were found in 1972 in Berlin, it does not mean that his body had lain there since in 45, and in fact, there is absolutely no conclusive evidence to suggest that. However, there is a great deal more evidence, new documentary evidence, to support the case that Martin Bormann did escape, not only escape, but with the help of British intelligence and the Allies. And after his death in the late 60s, which I absolutely believe, his remains were carefully moved and reburied in the place where historians claim that he fell. Now, upon the publication of the results of the Bormann 1998 DNA confirmation, London's Daily Express published a big article and called it Whitewash. And we know, Tony, that following World War II, now let's sort of just go off on a tangent now. Okay, Martin Bormann. Now, who was Martin Bormann? He was Hitler's handler. He managed all the funds of Nazi Germany. He was a pen pusher, okay? He was a clever pen pusher and a manipulator, but he was a pen pusher nevertheless. Don't forget, we spoke about this Operation Paperclip. The Americans headhunted numerous scientists that were physically involved with creating monstrous contraptions to murder people. They were taken, and they were taken to the USA, and they were made post-war heroes in America of being great scientists. Now, after World War II, Klaus Barbie, now everybody should know who's familiar with the dynamics of World War II, was known as the notorious Butcher of Lyon. Now, he was sentenced at the Nuremberg trial to death by hanging. He was groomed by the CIA and then given a new identity and sent to South America to help the USA infiltrate communist organizations to catch rebels such as Che Guevara. Now, isn't it shocking that the USA not only defied the international Nuremberg sentence of death for Barbie, but are also prepared, Tony, to collaborate with a cold-blooded murderer? And let's remember, Barbie used to take delight in skinning his victims alive and dipping their heads in ammonia. And this guy was a psychopath. So he was taken by the CIA, groomed, because they needed him. They sent him to South America. Now, when this was discovered, the French government went ballistic. So when they discovered this was a massive betrayal by the Allies, I mean, what was the Nuremberg trials for if it wasn't to put on trial all these murderers? So the Americans took him, they protected him, and the French then requested that Barbie be handed over immediately from the Americans for execution under international law. The United States of America flatly refused and promptly helped Barbie to escape, where I am, to Argentina, via one of the rat lines, which we know have been used to facilitate the escape of many Nazis from Europe. Now, if the United States government could blatantly fly in the face of the Nuremberg trial sentence, which they were actively participant in, how is it so unacceptable that nobody's going to protect Martin Bormann? Now, let's go back now. Between 1945 and 1965, there were numerous sightings of Bormann. And one of the witnesses that said that it was ignored because this is post the Nuremberg trials, Jacob Glass, who was Bormann's personal driver, said that he'd seen Bormann in Munich months after 1945. Let's fast forward a little bit now to 1981 and get onto the big boys. Now, we have Paul Manning, which I know you and Martin have spoken about frequently, because Paul Manning was a brilliant investigator. He was a former CBS war correspondent, you know, and he claimed that Borman escaped. But he didn't just claim it. You know, he went down to investigate and get his hands dirty, and he looked at the evidence. Now, his manuscript did not go down well with the establishment, as you know. And while he was attempting to publish his book, he was threatened. And finally, a renegade publisher had the guts to go ahead. They published his book after many refusals. And within a week of that publication, the publisher's legs were broken. And shortly after, we don't know if there's a connection, but shortly after, Manning's son was murdered. Now, supposedly that was a warning to say, you keep your mouth shut, you don't do this. So, you know, we've seen things around other personalities that have been involved, the Diana situation, whatever. You know, you do not open your mouth. Now, Paul Manning's published conclusions regarding Borman are very much in line with those of Christopher Crichton, John Ainsworth Davis. So they match up, who was the former intelligence officer. Now, Crichton states that Borman escaped, as does another personality which I have never been able to get hold of. I don't know if you have or Martin or everybody's heard. And his name was, he was a general, a British general, Ian Bell. Now, he was a Nazi war crimes investigator. Typical old school, army general, tough, clever, straight, you know, disciplined. He was doing his job. Now, he was commissioned post-1945 to be a crimes investigator. Now, if you go to YouTube, if anybody goes on there, I can't read off the link, I can't remember it, but if you YouTube or Google Ian Bell, Martin Borman escape, now you can see Bell, who was interviewed. I've never been able to get hold of this gentleman. I don't even know if he's still alive. And he tells us that he spotted Borman with a heavily guarded convoy traveling through the Austrian mountains, and he radioed back to British headquarters to report that he saw them, he saw Borman. And the instructions in quotes, he says, follow but do not apprehend. Now, I repeat, do not apprehend, end of quote. Now, Bell then followed Borman for many miles to the docks in the Italian port of Bari, which is a known Nazi escape route because all the big ships had come out of there. And Bell said he not only witnessed the cars from Borman's convoy being lifted onto the ship, but he insists that he saw Borman walking up the gangway and boarding the vessel. Now, that's the start of a genuine witness saying that he saw Borman physically leaving Europe. Okay, he got on the ship. Now we go forward and we go to Hugh Thomas. Now, Hugh Thomas, I don't know if you're aware of the book Doppelgangers, or any of your listeners have read the book Doppelgangers. Now, Hugh Thomas was a former physician, and he was author of this Doppelgangers book in 1995, and he wrote extensively about the 1992 forensics investigation. Now remember, he's a physician, he's qualified to make commentary about pathology, forensics, etc. Now, he suggests that Borman died certainly later than 1945, and why? He's looking on a scientific approach here.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that's, Lawrence, that's another book which just shows evidence which tallies up with JAD, John Ainsworth Davis, Christopher Crichton's account in OPJB. But ultimately, I mean, what's happened with the Borman money is that he's created these 750 companies, which ever since really the late 1940s, early 1950s, have been a kind of Nazi Fourth Reich. That is to say, using businesses to take over, and banks and this kind of thing, rather than to do the old fashioned thing, which was to use you know, the old Nazi stormtroopers and tanks to take things over. Anyway, what are you intending to do over the next few months, and will we be seeing a documentary from you, because you're right at the centre of this, and this is one of the things that we very much like to see is a bit of this on the mainstream TV, interviews with JAD, that kind of thing, which will actually move things on, because at the moment this whole idea that the Nazi wealth looted after World War II has just sort of disappeared into thin air, it doesn't really hold water for me.
The forensics are there in the official report. This is a post-1945 corpse, because the dating of the skeleton, I have to just mention this, the dating of the skeleton is older than a 45-year-old man, and Martin Borman was born in 1900. There was dentistry in there, which Professor Sonier testified, that was post-1950. Dead men do not go to the dentist, okay? And also we have the red clay encasing of the skull that is local to, it's exotic to Germany, it's local to Paraguay, where my investigation and others find Borman was first buried after his death. Now, when I fortunately, I was very, very privileged to become very close with John. I don't know if it's because I was a Navy brat. My father actually worked in, he was a Royal Naval Submariner, my father. And, of course, we sort of touched base on a lot of things because my father was also an officer in charge of escape training at the tank in Gosport, where actually Jad is very familiar. So we started to bond on a lot of sort of personal stories, etc. And it was quite interesting because when I told him about my father, he said, I know everything. And he knew everything. Now, we became very close, we started to talk, and I said, listen, we've got to get this story out. And he told me about the problems he's had, etc. Now, there are some things I cannot talk about on the air at the moment because legally they're very, very complicated, but I will be revealing further on and it will come out. Now that Jad has gone, fortunately, before he died over a year ago, we decided that we were going to set up a company. And we set up a company this year called Christopher Robin Media. Christopher Robin was a code name which Churchill affectionately called Jad as a child. We set up Christopher Robin Media, and Jad was a shareholder of this company and also a co-executive producer. And we are going to, it was set up specifically to prepare in film version three films on Jad's life and his operation. At the moment, we are talking with my partner, Richard Borman, who's also a media producer. We're actually talking, and I can't reveal the name, with a major international network at the moment who is extremely interested. But, of course, these are dangerous times. And now, one of the reasons I'm talking to you today, we have to really fast forward and get to move now, because losing Jad physically, Jad had a network of protection, and he had connections, etc. So we're trying to tidy up things and make sure nothing goes missing, and everything is there. But we did interviewed Jad on tape 4 months ago. He wasn't feeling great, but he said we have to get this done. And we actually have his tape testimony now. But it's not just tape testimony on camera. We've also got documents to back it up and paperwork, letters from Lord Louis Mountbatten to Jad, which I have seen and witnessed and have access to.
Okay, Lawrence, can I just ask you what your thoughts are about what's happened with the Borman Network and its effect on the world today, finally?
Sorry, I go off because I'm so focused on what's going on, you know, just losing Jad, it's been a really big one, so I'm still trying to tidy up loose ends. There's a chap here in South America, Uki Goni, he's a marvellous journalist. Now, last time we spoke, you said to me, Lawrence, what do you think happened to the Borman money? I have seen stuff and I have heard very, very good commentary on where this money did go into over 750 international companies. Now, I haven't focused on that, so I'm not qualified to make comments where that money is, who's got it, who's handling it, because I haven't seen it. I am qualified to say that I know Martin Borman was certainly here in 1952 and 1953. So the money, my focus really is trying to get the story out, more than just getting Jad's story out, get the evidence out he survived. Because then, Tony, people like you can do your job, because your job is actually to look for those trails of where this reach, all these financial trails lead. But if we do not prove that Martin Borman was alive in the 50s and the 60s, you're flogging a dead horse, because only then people can turn around and say, oh, shit, yeah, you know, yeah, he was out. So, okay, so he was out. So where did the money go? Do you realise, do people ever ask the question, with all today's forensic banking, internet, let's be honest, people are very clever. I mean, you can find out who's got what in their bank account. Isn't it curious, Tony, that not once anybody has revealed a statement from the government, we have found the funds that was taken by Nazi Germany. Have they ever been found? No. Or have they been found? Why have we never been told? We need to ask this question. Has anybody found the funds? Are you trying to tell me since 1945, with all the intelligence networks that we have, and the NSA, let's get it real, that are reading your and my email and listening to our phone conversations, and listening to this conversation, they haven't found the appropriated Nazi funds? And if they haven't found it, why haven't they told it? Why haven't they found it? And they've obviously found it. They know where it is. Of course they have. They've buried it. Nobody wants to talk about this. We must expose the fact that our governments are lying to us and hiding information to us.
Okay, Lawrence, thanks very much for that. We look forward very much to your forthcoming film about this, which will is likely to come out in the next, well, goodness knows how many months. But in the meantime, if listeners are really interested in the story, they can still read Christopher Crichton's Op JB. Very sad to hear about the passing of, that was his pen name, of course, of John Ainsworth Davis, aged 89 this week. So thanks very much for joining us from Buenos Aires, Lawrence.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you very much.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, what do you make of the significance of this? I mean, it is fascinating what she's saying there. The forensics, I can see why she's focusing on that, saying, look, let's not mess about. Borman did survive and he was in South America. But what do you think of the implications for today?
Well, I think, as Lawrence was pointing out, there's no doubt or dispute that people like Barbie and also Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, became trusted members of the intelligence community in the West and part of NATO. There was an executive decision. As the OSS, the Office of Secret Services, turned into the CIA, they, under Operation Paperclip, with the collaboration with the British, recruited the senior Nazis into the NATO intelligence structure. And I don't think there's any dispute about that. That's not conspiracy theory. I mean, Reinhard Gehlen, who became the head of the BND, the German equivalent of MI6, was indeed the head of the Gestapo under Hitler. And of course the Russians knew that, and of course there's no real secret about it. So people have got to realise that the Western intelligence services, including MI6 and the CIA, were and are collaborators with the Nazis, and that of course explains a lot of their behaviour, including things like the Bologna bomb and 9/11 and so on.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Also, Martin, this week we've seen a bit of sabre rattling. Oh gosh, not again. US flying B-52 bombers into the new zone of defence for the Chinese. Is there anything serious to worry about here? The Chinese have extended quite a large zone further beyond their borders, the places that they expect the American military and any other unfriendly military to keep out. And the Japanese and the US have been flying into these areas.
Yeah, well, it's about disputed islands, which I've, the name I've forgotten. The Japanese call them one name, the Chinese call them another name. They both claim these islands. And of course, what it's really about is the oil, which is potentially under the South China Sea, which they all want to get their hands on. All over the world, conflicts are bubbling away.
Well, another one is in Thailand, isn't it?
Yes.
We've had the headquarters of the army invaded by 1,200 protesters in Thailand.
Yeah, the Thai situation I find quite difficult. I mean, obviously, I'm not an expert in every part of the world. I try and follow things. No, I try and follow things because people need to realise that things are all happening all over the world, are all interconnected, and therefore it's worth your while trying to join the dots together. You've got Thaksin Shinawatra, who's been forced out in Thailand, and his sister is now running the country. They did win an election, but there are, as always, people disputing whether the election was free and fair. We've had an election in Honduras this week, which has been won by the right wing, but the left wing are claiming that it's not a free and fair election, just as people have done in Ukraine and in other places around the world.
Yes, whilst you're mentioning Ukraine, what's going on there? It seems like they're shilly-shallying in Ukraine as to whether they really want to be allied with the EU or with Russia.
Well, I mean, the problem is that the geography of the situation. I mean, Marina, our colleague here, is from Ukraine and she will know the difficulties. Ukraine is being pulled in two directions simultaneously. Many people in the west of the Ukraine who speak Ukrainian and have a Western orientation, they tend to be Uniate Catholics, they want to be part of the EU and NATO. In the eastern part of the Ukraine, people tend to be Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, and they also tend to be Russian speakers, and they don't particularly want to go in that direction. They've got their orientation is more towards Moscow, and lots of the heavy industry in Ukraine is located in the Donbass Basin, which is in the eastern part of the Ukraine, so they don't really want an IMF structural adjustment program to put them all out of work either. And I think what's happened with the current government in Ukraine is that they would like to join the EU and NATO, but they realise that that's going to annoy the Russians, and the Russians are in a position to make Ukraine's life quite difficult if they don't play ball. So they've got a balancing act to pursue. And the real danger, and one that people should really take note of, is that Ukraine could collapse into a sectarian disturbances similar to the Yugoslavia or Syria. And the difference between Yugoslavia and Syria and Ukraine is Ukraine has got nuclear weapons.
Well, a little bit closer, and also on the nuclear theme, Scotland. We've had a lot of talk this week about Scottish independence. I mean, this doesn't seem to be something which has actually welled up from the goodness of the hearts of the Westminster politicians. It's something which is more to do with the strength of the Scottish Parliament, which, of course, is actually there as a sort of regional parliament and has been put there, persuaded by the European Union originally, the same with the Welsh.
Well, not really, as part of their regional agenda. No. The Welsh and the Scottish National Parties have been around since long before the European Union, and they've basically made progress because of the mismanagement of both Wales, Scotland and Ireland by governments run by white middle-class chaps from the south of England. And it's nothing to do with the EU at all. I don't think the IRA were created by the EU, were they? And I think
Well, that's Ireland, isn't it? It's not Wales or Scotland.
The SNP and the and Plaid Cymru were founded at the same sort of time as Sinn Féin was in the early part of the 19th century. So the idea that, that Wales and Scotland have got independence from England as a result of bureaucrats in Brussels is, I'm afraid, the sort of silly stuff that you get from middle-class people south of the Wash. You don't know
much
about anything.
It's not just middle-class people that say that sort of thing. It's lots of people, lots of people across Europe that talk about this regionalisation
agenda.
Well, the
real problem for the Scottish nationalists, and you've seen this,
I mean, we've had this nuclear dispute this week as to whether there is actually going to be a nuclear base in Scotland in the future.
Well, indeed, and because the Scottish don't want a nuclear base there. They don't want one. And of course, their politicians can't do anything about it because they're part of a United Kingdom. Some people don't want to be part of. I think they'll probably lose the referendum.
But we've just stopped all shipbuilding in Portsmouth, for example, which does seem to sort of hamstring, in order to try and keep
Scotland inside the Union. But maybe Scotland shouldn't be. If I was Scots, I'd be very tempted to vote to leave the Union. I would, very definitely. But from an English point of view, that's a bit problematic because it then leaves us being ruled by Westminster here in Bristol without allies from Edinburgh. And that's problematic. But nevertheless, from a Scottish perspective, you can see why some people might think that it's about time that instead of being ruled by people... I mean, basically, Scotland has never voted Conservative ever in the last generation, the last 30 or 40 years. But they've got exactly the same policies as everybody has. In fact, the poll tax was forced on Scotland a year before England just in order to annoy them. That was the way that they didn't try to force it in Northern Ireland. They still haven't even got the community charge in Northern Ireland. They've still got the rates and they've still got council houses.
So what's
your actual fact? They made so much trouble.
I mean, I know which way you've said which way you would probably vote if you were Scottish.
No, I'd be in two minds.
Which way do you think it's going to go?
I think probably the Scots will not vote for independence. I think what most Scots want is more power for a Scottish Parliament, but they don't want to leave a federal UK.
And of course, probably the biggest story of the week internationally is this Iran nuclear treaty.
Yes, very positive if it can be pulled off. But of course, there's all sorts of people who are not happy. It's very disadvantageous for the Iranians. They've gone really out of their way to bend over backwards. I mean, there's all sorts of unreasonable conditions been put on them. But I think that they've taken the wise view that they're not so bothered about having... They certainly don't want nuclear weapons. They've made that clear. So they can give up not having nuclear weapons easily enough because they don't want any.
They don't want to make them.
Well, they don't want them at all. They don't really see them as... There's no real strategic value in having them apart from deterring Israeli nuclear attack.
Well, exactly. This is the thing that is the elephant in the room in a lot of these discussions, which isn't mentioned, is the massive nuclear firepower of the Israelis. I mean, they've got 300, several... They've
300.
But they've also got these Dolphin-class submarines built for them by the Germans. Well, two of them were not sold to them
by the Germans.
They were given by the Germans as war Holocaust reparations to the Israelis. And these are not only nuclear powered, they're also nuclear equipped with nuclear warheaded cruise missiles. But these surely are more threatening than the Iranians. You can understand
why the Iranian general staff might be saying to their elected politicians, well, look, the Israelis have got all these nuclear weapons, so have the Americans, we've got to have them too.
The Syrians have given up their chemical weapons, yeah, and the Iranians are reining back their nuclear program. What are they getting in exchange for it?
Well, in theory, they're going to get sanctions lifted on
their
country.
Less sanctions?
Yeah. So in other words, we will stop kicking you in the teeth if you do as we say. The Iranians are negotiating under duress, but I think that they are wise in presuming that there's no real strategic benefit for them in having nuclear weapons. Because in actual fact, if the Israelis were to launch a nuclear strike on Iran, they wouldn't be able to hit them back with nuclear weapons, but they'd be able to make it hurt.
Finally, a sort of, I suppose, international story. It's not really, but it was Dominic Grieve, I think, conservative politician, talking about how dangerous the Pakistani community was being corrupt here in Britain. Not a most helpful comment, particularly since when they privatised the uranium, which they're planning to do soon, British Uranium Agency, that some of the people buying that may well be Pakistanis themselves. So on the one hand, they're saying we don't trust the Pakistanis, they're corrupt, and on the other hand, they're saying, oh well, let's let them have our uranium.
Well, educated people in Pakistan don't trust the British and the Americans because they are corrupt. And in actual fact, recently the elected Pakistani government was trying to negotiate a ceasefire with the Taliban and Tikriti, I think they're called, which are inside Pakistan, and they said to the elected governments of Pakistan have been saying to us for a long time, will you stop sending drone strikes in here killing innocent people in our country? Will you stop? Will you stop? Will you stop? I mean, the young woman that was shot in the head by the Taliban for being a schoolgirl was met with Obama, and she's only 16 years old. I've forgotten the name of her name, and she said, will you please stop doing illegal drone strikes in Pakistan? It's not doing any good, which was rather embarrassing for Obama and all the rest of them, but she was telling them the truth, and I felt good for you, girl, when she said that. And she was also asked what she wants to do when she grows up, and said, I want to go into politics in my country. Now, educated people in Pakistan who read real newspapers, lots and lots of print, lots more print than you'll find even in The Independent, and they're already educated, they're only a small minority, but they know an awful lot about what goes on in the world and about terrorism. They know, for example, about Raymond Davis, the CIA man who shot two people who were following him, arrested by the local police in Pakistan. They got hold of his telephone, and he's a CIA man, and he's on the phone to all the top terrorists in Pakistan. So in other words,
supplying them, in fact, with weapons of mass destruction.
So in actual fact, the Pakistani army, which was trained by the British, they know very well that in actual fact the Americans and the British are engaged in terrorist activities inside their country, just as they probably are inside Syria. Because as we know, the former French foreign minister Roland Dumas said on French television like a few months ago now, that before the Arab Spring he was approached by British officials, he didn't say who, probably MI6, saying, we are going to run an armed rebellion in Syria, do you want to buy into it? Which means, and he said it was the British, not the Americans, which means that it may well be MI6, possibly with the collusion of number 10, which began the war in Syria. Now, somebody has got to explain to me, the former French foreign minister, a right-wing foreign minister in the Sarkozy government, he says Britain started the war in Syria. I want to hear from the British prime minister, did we or didn't we? If he says no, we didn't, then he's probably a liar. And if he says yes, we did, I want him sent to The Hague. And it possibly they should be sent to The Hague either way.
Also, to mention Egypt. So much water under the bridge in Egypt. But this week we're hearing that it's not just the Islamic activists which are being arrested. Also, Egypt's highest profile secular activists are also being threatened by arrest now. And what they're saying is basically it's back to the bad old days of Mubarak. It's as if the Arab Spring had never happened.
Well, obviously it's a complicated situation, very difficult to read. I've been reading lots of books about Egypt and I've been trying to follow it. I hope that they can sort it out because, of course, Egypt is the key country for the whole region. If they can make democracy work, there's some chance for everybody else. If they can't, there's probably
But there's a
no
massive
hope.
Government crackdown. This is a military government.
Oh, yeah.
Massive government crackdown on any kind of dissent. So what was the point of the Arab Spring in this case?
Revolutions very rarely succeed at the first push. Look how long it took to get rid of apartheid South Africa, to defeat communist totalitarianism.
So why did the democracy support the military in taking over from the democratic
movement? Because there is divisions within the society. The Muslim Brotherhood were the most well-organised force in Egypt because basically they were more cohesive than all the other
A democratically elected president is in jail.
Yes, on that. But of course, his opponents would claim that he wasn't properly democratically elected, just as people claiming. I mean, it was very close. If he did win, it was only by a percentage.
Yeah, but
point.
It doesn't mean to say he should go to jail.
No. I totally agree with you. I think the real problem here is once we get to a situation where normal procedures have been suspended, then it's. I mean, what we said in Syria was unless they had a democratic election, then people are absolutely justified, and British special forces have been training them to blow things up, to shoot people, to assassinate informers, and all the things that you've got to do. Now, if you remove the democratically elected government of Egypt, then they're perfectly entitled to say, we want British special forces to come in here and train us to kill the Egyptian army, which is supplied by the Americans. Oh, it all gets very, very messy once you start not having rules about democracy in the first place. And also, of course, this is what the West has got to understand. Once you start saying that it's okay for people to take up arms against undemocratic regimes, which is what they are saying in Syria, absolutely, then I say, then that's the same is true for Saudi Arabia, which has never had a democratic election, has got no chance of having one, and no prospect of having one. Therefore, armed struggle against that regime is absolutely justified by exactly the same token as we say it's justified against Assad. But that means their allies are also legitimate targets. That means people who are supplying Saudis with weapons, and they're doing that from Bristol. Lots of people earn their living supplying Saudi Arabia with weapons in Bristol. But the Saudi Arabian regime is not a democratic regime. Therefore, people are entitled to an armed struggle against it, just as they are against Assad. And that means they're allowed to struggle in an armed way against the people who are supplying weaponry to the regime. Well, and that includes a lot of people in Bristol who are going home tonight in their cars, having done their overtime this week. You are supplying the Saudi regime with weaponry. That means you are a potential combatant.
Okay, well, not okay, I suppose.
No, it's not okay, is it?
Also, Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia has threatened Sochi Olympics, hasn't he?
This was a few weeks ago now. It's all reported in the Daily Telegraph. He went to see President Putin and said, look, let's do a deal over Syria. You stop supporting Assad and we won't attack we won't get our Chechen rebels to attack the Winter Olympics. That's a deal.
Okay.
And Putin just said, no, it's not.
Naughty Prince Bandar. Anyway, we'll see what happens to him over the next few weeks.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
So, is Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne a cokehead in denial? Well, there's a fascinating interview this week on a brand new internet channel called The People's Voice, which has been talked about for probably years now, and it's had a couple of false starts, but it's actually there online now. So why is Osborne trying to cover up his coke-snorting exploits from the 1990s? We hear now former dominatrix and author of Chief Whip, the new book, Chief Whip, Natalie Rao, and how she was raided by the police too when she released a photo of herself with George Osborne and a gram or so of cocaine sitting on the table in front of them. His lawyers apparently have been threatening the papers not to print it. So let's have a listen now to Natalie Rao's interview with Sonia Paulton, the former Daily Mail columnist, on the People's Voice TV this week.
The girls that worked for me, and I'm going to be, I'm going to be clear, they were prostitutes.
Right.
I only sent them on one occasion in 1994 to the Bundling Club. I'd sat down with Christopher Coleridge, George Osborne, and William Sinclair to describe the kind of girls they wanted to send, and I was A, to supply the girls, and B, to supply the cocaine. I sat with all three of them, George, William, Christopher, and discussed what kind of type of girls, how much drugs they wanted. They described what kind of girls they wanted, i.e. this Naomi Campbell lookalike.
Right.
What they meant was they didn't want anyone fat.
Right.
They wanted tall, slim.
Right. Now, I'd like to draw on some evidence here. I'm sure many people have seen this picture. This is currently being pulled off at the internet at a rate of knots. Could you please tell us the truth about this picture once and for all?
Papers have known about what I'm about to say to you now since 2005. But for some reason, they either don't print it or they're being bullied. And I know for a fact that Osborne's henchmen, called lawyers, put the heat on a lot of the papers.
Right.
So I'm very disappointed about. When I thought that, we live in a society where, we had freedom of speech, but we've got a government right now that's literally trying to censor every single thing that comes out that is against them or about them.
Right.
or doesn't help them. That photograph there, the drug dealer that was there on the night, it was taking the photo. I said to him, be careful, we don't want to have the cocaine in the actual picture. So I actually moved the vase thinking it would actually hide the coke. Clearly it didn't. And that's why I got the flowers in my face. It isn't just a line, but it's a few lines. It's probably about a gram of cocaine there, of which George Osborne took on that night and prior to that night. regularly in my company and others. Lately, they decided to cut that bit of the picture out. Clearly, Osborne's got a little part to play in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I read that you then subsequently experienced a dawn raid by drug officers.
Yeah, had the radio on LBC. I love to listen to that in the mornings.
Right.
And I heard a knock on the door, and and when I looked at the peephole, there was a person dressed as, I now know it was a police officer, but he was dressed as a postman.
Right.
And
dressed as a postman?
He was dressed as a postman.
Okay.
And he said he had a delivery for Natalie Rowe. Well, Natalie Rowe isn't actually my real name.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't normally get a delivery in that name.
Right.
So I was suspicious. But I'd had a visit the night before from a journalist from the Mail on Sunday.
Right.
So I thought it was another journalist trying to speak to me. So I said to him, leave it on the doorstep and I'll come out and get it. And he put it on the floor and I could see through the people. But I thought, well, the postman wouldn't do that because you've got a sign for it.
Right.
But he did actually look at the parcel and pretend that he was reading. I said, who's it for? He said, N Row. He then went around the corner. I could still see he hadn't gone out the actual building. And so I opened it with my chain on and said, you can take the parcel with you. I can't remember if I said I don't believe you're a postman, but I said, take it with you. Just as I shut the door, I looked through people again and saw just a rush of black figures. And it was, open the door, drug squad. And I had a top on and my knickers. And I said, can I just put my skirt on? And they said, no, and open it now, otherwise we're going to break the door in. So I literally had to open the door at that instant.
I'd like to talk a little bit about this book.
Okay.
You refer to a character called Joe
right,
in there.
Right.
Who is Joe?
Well, it's not Boris Johnson from what people have been
saying.
Okay,
okay. Joe is
George.
George Osborne.
Yes.
Okay, so can you tell
me... And can I also say, yes? I never said at any point, which I've read in the papers, the day that Sunday People printed the story, the serialisation.
Yeah.
I didn't say that Joe was not George Osborne.
Right.
And my publishers got involved with that and their lawyers.
Right.
And it's annoying.
Right.
I didn't want to change any of the names in the book.
Right.
It was taken out of my control.
Who took that out of your control?
But my publisher, and it was also my agent.
Right.
Martin, fascinating, I think. But this is using the pressure of lawyers to actually try and suppress this story, suppress the photo, this sort of thing. Why won't George Osborne just come clean about this?
Well, I mean, I wish he would. I mean, obviously, we're all having a laugh at his expense if he's been caught out here. But I mean, what is he actually doing? He's basically paying for sex, which isn't illegal, and he's taking drugs, which is, and you could argue that both of these things are his own business. And for most ordinary people, I'd say it is their own business. But if you're a politician claiming to be anti-drugs, as he does, and presumably anti-paid sex, as he also probably is, then you're a hypocrite. And that's why you're fair game.
But I mean, a lot of people would ask, is he the right sort of person? Is he reliable enough to actually be put in charge of the entire nation's finances?
Well, throughout World War II, Winston Churchill was drinking brandy for breakfast, apparently, but people put up with it because they could see that he had other qualities that were worth having. I don't think it should rule you out of being in politics if you have taken drugs at some stage or other. In fact, virtually all major politicians on both sides of the Atlantic probably have,
anyway,
apart from a few.
Okay.
That's the problem.
If you want to follow this sort of thing, it's online. It's called www.thepeoplesvoice.tv.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Finally then tonight, Beast Technology. How would you like a superpower pill that lets you into cars and through security just by touching things after you've swallowed one of these pills? Let's hear now from DARPA's former director, Defence Advanced Research Projects, Regina Duggan.
Well, we're thinking of a whole variety of options for how you could do better at authentication. So you can start with nearer term things like tokens or fobs that might have NFC or Bluetooth embedded in them, but you can also think about a means of authentication that you could simply wear on your skin every day for a week at a time, say an electronic tattoo. I'm profoundly interested in wearables. We've made a lot of advances in wearables, but there's still some fundamental problems that we haven't solved. Like, one of them is the mechanical mismatch between humans and electronics, right? So electronics are boxy and rigid, humans are curvy and soft. That's a mechanical mismatch problem. Well, a researcher at the University of Illinois, his name is Dr. Rogers, what he discovered is that he could use standard CMOS techniques to make islands of high-performance silicon connected by accordion-like structures that would allow it to stretch up to 200% and still be performing. And what he did is he founded a company and they started making electronic tattoos. So I'm wearing one here on my arm. This is a developmental system made by MC10. It has an antenna and some sensors embedded in it. And what we plan to do is work with them to advance a tattoo that could be used for authentication. Now, it may be true that 10 to 20-year-olds don't want to wear a watch on their wrist, but you can be sure that they'll be far more interested in wearing an electronic tattoo, if only to piss off their parents. Right? And that's something that you wear, but you could also imagine including authentication in just your daily habits. So I take a vitamin every morning. What if I could take vitamin authentication? Vitamin authentication. Look, I have one right here. This pill has a small chip inside of it with a switch. It also has what amounts to an inside-out potato battery. When you swallow it, the acids in your stomach serve as the electrolyte.
That's what they do.
And they power it up, and the switch goes on and off. And it creates an 18-bit ECG-like signal in your body, and essentially your entire body becomes your authentication token. So what this means is that becomes my first superpower. I really want this superpower. It means that my arms are like wires, my hands are like alligator clips. When I touch my phone, my computer, my door, my car, I'm authenticated in.
That was DARPA, that sort of beast technology, pretty frightening. Anyway, time to sign off. No Cyrus the Virus, I'm afraid, until after Christmas. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith, of course, to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. If you want to follow the show online, we're at www.thisweek.org.uk. See you next week.
News on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. The trial of the two men accused of the murder of Fusilier Lee Rigby has heard he was mutilated in the street after being deliberately hit.